Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
It is Tim Phillips, live and in person. You look surprisingly, you know, not stressed out, considering I know your tremendous addiction to betting on basketball.
Yes, yeah. I do, and I like to bet on games from like 2012,
because
I tend to win on those bets.
Pretty safe bets when you know the outcome. Unlike some other people we can name. Anyway, End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the white-knuckle crime drama Uncut Gems. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we'll look at some of the movie news from the past week, including no Oscar for J-Lo or Adam Sandler or Eddie Murphy. They were all snubbed by the Academy, and according to one member, they kind of deserve it. And then the Oscars are on TV this Sunday, and we will offer some of our predictions about who will win and who should win. But first, we are going to talk about film. And by talking about film, we mean talking about literal physical film.
Yeah.
Because it was announced this week that the five major Hollywood studios have reached a deal with Kodak. Yes, Kodak is still open.
Kodak's is still in business.
And it sounds like Hollywood is single-handedly keeping it afloat. But it is interesting. I mean, you know, to think about film, you know, I remember the when the conversion started. You know, I worked at Zellers, the electronic counter at Zellers, and part of the business was collecting people's rolls, sending them out, getting them back in a couple of days. And then, you know, we started selling digital cameras.
Right.
And, you know, it just, you know, that was about 3 years, like from 99, 2000 till, you know, when I didn't work at Zellers anymore in 2003, but just like watching that conversion, that's sort of like this, it was like a de-evolution. It was crazy. And, you know, it's crazy now to think Kodak is still,
still in
making
business.
Film.
Because they're always an example of, oh, they didn't change with the times. They're like the Yellow Pages or like, you know, Blockbuster. But
yeah,
this article, it's surprising, but pleasantly surprised. So many great directors are championing the cause of film. And that's really helping Kodak, because there is power in some of these directors like Tarantino, Greta Gerwig, Noah Baumbach, who are all in favor of film.
Yeah, and you know, like half the best picture slate, it was directed on film, as you said, you know, Little Women, Marriage Story, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, also Irishman to an extent, and I imagine it was not so much an aesthetic choice for Scorsese, but a matter of just it's easier to fiddle with VFX when it's on digital. There's no like transferring it and adapting it to digital and all that. You know, it would just be easier. So what I can imagine is that you probably in those scenes where you have the quote unquote older De Niro, you know, where they're wearing like actual old age makeup. Those are the film scenes, and the digital scenes are the ones where they look where they've been de-aged. So that's, I mean, it's interesting that, and it's what I found interesting too is that it's not just like the old timey people like Scorsese, that it is Greta Gerwig, who's, you know, relatively new as a director. Baumbach, who doesn't really make movies where it's like, I need the film aesthetic. I need like the big vista. I'm making an IMAX
film. 70 millimeter.
Right.
The 70 millimeter chamber drama.
No one's going to see Marriage Story in IMAX. And then you also have Christopher Nolan, who's very much likes the option. I think he even said something to the effect of, you know, it's not cinema without the film. That's part of the whole thing.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, Greta Gerwig. That's good. That's showing the future. The future is still in favor of film. But she's one director, and Quentin Tarantino's was already mentioning one of the reasons he wanted to get out of filmmaking was it was all going digital. He said that a few years ago. So, like you're saying, a lot of the directors we're mentioning are sort of an older vintage. Even Noah Baumbach, I think his first movie was in the 90s. So he's even. So it'd be nice to see maybe some younger directors like Greta Gerwig or whoever's up and coming really be in favor of film, because it's probably a lot easier to go digital, but you know, it's sort of like those, sort of like Neil Young just loves vinyl, right? You have to have a love for it to really, really promote it.
Well, I did like, Paul Thomas Anderson said that, you know, film requires you to have like a greater attention to detail and a greater care because, you know, you only have so much of it. And whereas digital, you can shoot for hours and hours. I mean, you know, it creates a lot of opportunity because there's a lot of opportunity to riff and not screw up. But on the other hand, if you're using film, you're going to try and make damn sure you get it at least like in one take or two takes. You're not, you know, I mean, unless you're Stanley Kubrick, of course, but he's no longer with us. But that's an aspect to this as well. The flip side of it, too, and I was thinking of Ong Lee, who's been pushing like 8K, 120 FPS. That requires a lot of care, too. Because everything is so sharp and so vital and so bright, so like your shot composites, because everything is in frame, has to be perfect as well. That there has to be a lot of care there too, because any mistake, you can't just hide it with a little flubbing or a little focusing.
No.
It every mistake is going to stick out like a sore thumb too. So it's interesting that we're kind of going in these two directions where, you know, you believe the Paul Thomas Anderson point of view, like film, you know, makes you less careless. Well, if you're also shooting 8K, you also have to be careful too.
Yeah. It's all about the expenses going into it for sure. And like you're saying, even with new technology, when it's the cutting edge and most expensive, you have to be careful with that too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, there's sort of a romantic notion about film.
Yes.
Like I was saying, it's the same as with music, with vinyl. There's sort of a romantic notion about it. So
yeah,
I think that'll keep it alive, but will it flourish going forward? It'll be tough to say once people like Scorsese, Tarantino have retired or are no longer.
Yeah, because that's the thing, right? If it didn't have like the big names attached, like Nolan, like Tarantino, like Scorsese, Spielberg as well. I think West Side Story remake is going to be filmed. J.J. Abrams, too, shot Star Wars on film. You know, without these big sort of names attached to it, would Hollywood, like, be bothered? Like, this is becoming an incredibly frugal business where there's, like, no room for error. Everything has to be a big home run success anymore. Like, we can't have these, like, small successes where we make $10, $20 million on a film. We have to make billions of dollars on a film. Would they bother if it wasn't for these guys? If it wasn't for, like, sort of, like, the biggest guys, the brand name guys pushing for it?
Yeah, I don't think they would.
Yeah.
I think it'd be tough in that circumstance. So
yeah.
Yeah. And if the newer directors, the ones who are doing Marvel movies and stuff, start saying they want to shoot on film too, that could help the cause too. Otherwise, I think it'll have a life that's good for Kodak, but it might be tough going down the, you know, 20, 30 years from now, unless people are really, you know, learning about it in film school, really love the film and want to use it once they start making their movies, right?
You're right. But, I mean, the vinyl comparison is apt, too, because vinyl came back to such an extent where, like, the plants that make vinyl records just couldn't keep up with demand because there were so few of them at that point. And, you know, maybe, you know, again, if it catches on, people, you know, watching Nolan films today suddenly like, oh, yeah, this is awesome. Like, there's something about this that clicks maybe better than just shooting on your... I mean, you have some people who shoot on their iPhones. You know, Soderbergh is sort of the antithesis to all this because he's been, you know, using digital for so long and even he's gone so far as to experiment with iPhones. So
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, he was all about sex, lies, and videotape. So videotape back in the day. So now he's still into the digital.
Yeah, he was an early adapter.
Yeah,
exactly. We're going to get to our Oscar predictions in a sec, but Tim found this article, which, you know, sort of went by me. I like to think I have my finger on the pulse, but it addresses what has been, I think, a primary controversy is that a lot of hopefuls, a lot of people we were expecting to be nominated for Oscars weren't. So we're talking about people like Jennifer Lopez for Hustlers and Adam Sandler for Uncut Gems and Eddie Murphy for Dolomite Is My Name. It turns out that there was a very good reason. And we have Terry Moore to thank for this, who was an Oscar nominee for Come Baby Little Sheba.
One of your all-time favorites,
not,
right?
Not exactly part of the Criterion collection. Although, it's funny, she was apparently married to Howard Hughes, but there was no mention of her in The Aviator.
No.
They kind of skipped right over her.
Must have been like a weekend marriage or something.
I don't know, but she, yeah. You know, here's what she said about J-Lo. She said, I would have been shocked if she had got it. Her performance was rough around the edges. She's not an actor. You know, J-Lo's been... Basically, that J-Lo's being like a personality.
Yes, more a phenomenon a more than of a an phenomenon. Actress.
Thank you. She's, yes, and that was the reason why Lady Gaga didn't win last year either.
Right, because Olivia Colman is more of an actor's actor.
Yeah. Yes.
And this seems to be common common opinions, because there's this Terry Moore, but there were others in the article of different ages. Terry Moore, 91 years old, which is great. I'm not going to be an ageist, but...
She's hung on.
Might have a different perspective than a lot of people. Yeah. And yeah, it's all like a common opinion is that you have to be an actor's actor, and it's all about like what you've done in the past. So when you're talking about like somebody like Adam Sandler for Uncut Gems, they're like, somebody said that performance was a tour de force, but then he does these cheesy, dumb Netflix comedies. So we can't celebrate him because he doesn't have the reverence for filmmaking or the Academy or anything like that. So even if you give an outstanding performance in a movie, there's like no objective criteria for that. It's all about who you are, right?
And
like,
it's a self-fulfilling prophecy too, because Adam Sandler, I mean, granted, I think he just signed a $300 million deal to make more dumb Netflix comedies. Yeah. But, you know, so he likes that too. But, I mean, he also likes going bold and doing these, like, really out-of-left-field things like Uncut Gems, like Punch Drunk Love, like the Meyerowitz stories. Even Funny People, even though he was playing a comedian in that, was not, like, a yuckity-yuck-yuck-yuck Adam Sandler movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if, like, if the quote-unquote vanguard, like, gave him, like, some positive reinforcement, if he might, like, seek out the challenges more.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like he does the comedies. He does, like, the teaming up with, you know, all the usual crew, David Spade, Kevin James, Chris Rock, and all that, and they go and do their thing. And then he maybe gets bored of that and wants to try out, you know, something like an Uncut Gems. And, you know... Everybody, he delivers these performances where they're like, oh, wow, I forgot Adam Sandler has that in him.
Yeah.
And would he be a bit more engaged if, like, the establishment was like, you know what, Adam, you did such a good job in this movie. We should try you out in other things, too. It's like, you know, come join the club.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, if you know anything about Adam Sandler, he's not, a very extroverted person, despite his his comedic leanings.
Yeah.
So maybe being invited into, like, being part of the club maybe might, you know, give him that boost of confidence to keep being bold instead of retreating back into the schmoochie-boochies, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think the voting, and I think voting will always be political for this. Like, if you or I were voting, there'd probably be, like, considerations.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems like they're voting down the road for somebody. It's like, okay, Adam Sandler, like, if he does three more gripping movies, the third one down the road, he'll get the Oscar for it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I read something as a separate article. Somebody, they're just brutally honest last year, I think, for, like, who they were voting for the Oscars. And the guy was like, Spike Lee, Black Klansman. He's been screwed over for so long, I'm giving it to him. He should have won it for Do the Right Thing. Well, yeah, he should have won it for Do the Right Thing. Maybe he should have won it for Black Klansman. But just to say, just because he's been screwed over for so long, we're going to give it to him.
But that's a trend with the Oscars, right? It's like DiCaprio. They'll, like, put it off. And it's like, then he does The Revenant. It's like, I guess we have to give it to him now. And it was the same with Kate Winslet. She was like, Sense and Sensibility. You know, Titanic, Revolution Road, on and on. And then it's like The Reader, which is probably like, of all her like Oscar nominated performances, is probably like the bottom of like in terms of like, not that she was bad, but it wasn't like a great movie. But by that point, it's like, oh, fine, give it to her.
Yeah,
and like, and we'll get into this when we talk about predictions, but it's going to be the same thing with Saoirse Ronan. It's like she'll get like Oscar nomination 10, and somebody at the Academy is going to be like, "Fine, just give it to her." She's 32 years old and been nominated for 12 movies in 10 years.
Yeah.
So, and then to the other thing was Eddie Murphy, and Terry Moore said that he was campaigning too hard for it. It's like, do you remember Harvey Weinstein?
Oh, yeah. I think it's all about campaigning in a lot of the regards. Like, it's a separate article. I think I saw Jonathan Pryce was really, really nice to the Academy and was campaigning a little bit or whatever, going to all the dinners. So he's nominated, right? And then Eddie Murphy, this gentleman saying, why did he host Saturday Night Live? It's like, that is campaigning for an Oscar. He hadn't hosted that. He hadn't been on that show in over 30 years. How dare he host Saturday Night Live?
I mean, first of all, he kind of owes his career to Saturday Night Live. Yeah. Saturday Night Live also kind of owes its continued existence to him. But, you know, it was a reciprocal relationship. But, I mean, beside that, just like, it struck me as odd that, you know, I know Harvey Weinstein is pretty much persona non grata in Hollywood now. But, I mean, there was a time where Harvey said, this is an Oscar-nominated movie, and you better freaking nominate
it. They would just shove it right down their throats. It'd be like,
That's how you get Chocolat.
Chocolat,
like a Best Picture nominee.
Man, that's, how did that happen, you know? anybody watch it? I don't think people watch some of these movies, right? They're just like, okay.
It's like, Chocolat. All right. I guess.
Like, I had high expectations as nominated for all these Oscars. I like chocolate. I go in, I watch it. I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah, it's, I mean, to say that, you know, he was campaigning too hard. Well, that's kind of how it happens. Like, there is a political structure. It's like with the Hollywood, the stars on the Walk of Fame. Everyone thinks it's like, you are anointed. What, like, your talent is being recognized. It's like, no, you signed a freaking check to this commission, and then they put your star on it.
Yeah.
That's how Donald Trump has a star on the Walk of Fame, because he likes to sign checks and be awarded things.
Yeah.
Ta-da. So, it was interesting reading this. Like, these people who are willing to follow themselves, but anyway, very informative. Yeah. We're going to queue up our own Oscar predictions next. In the meantime, we're going to tip our hat to the great Oscar songbook, sort of. You'll recognize this song in a sec. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. That was Take My Breath Away, but that was not Berlin. That was the Sublime Reggae King singing the 1986 winner for Best Original Song.
Nice.
Yeah. So, we're going to talk about this year's Oscars. They air this Sunday. These Oscars have not been without controversy, a lot of accusations about lack of diversity. I think there's probably some strong accusations about lack of nominating the right people, as we were previously discussing. So we're going to do four categories: Best Picture, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director. And then we're going to have a Dealer's Choice segment where we pick a category where we talk about who should win and who will win. And we're going to do that for all the categories. So why don't we just start with Best Director? Tim, who do you think will win Best Director and who should win Best Director? Actually, I'll do the nominees really quick. The nominees are Martin Scorsese, Todd Phillips, Sam Mendes, Quentin Tarantino, and Bong Joon-ho.
I think Bong Joon-ho should win for Parasite. I think it was one of the best movies I saw this year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best movies of the decade, probably, along with the one we're going to review later. I think those are my two favorite from the year.
Yeah.
I'm thinking I haven't seen 1917, so Sam Mendes seems to have a lot of buzz, and from what I hear, he's, you know, it's a great.
Mm-hmm.
It's directed really well, from what I hear, but I don't really know a whole lot about it. So I think he may win, but I wouldn't be surprised if Bong Joon-ho actually wins.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to say Sam Mendes will win, and Bong Joon-ho is who should win.
Yeah, you kind of read my mind on that, although I would... I think this is going to be one of those years where it's going to be a split decision on Best Picture and Best Director, and I think it could go either way with, like, Best Picture... 1917 or Best and Best Director Bong Joon-ho, or it could also be flipped as well. But yeah, I would agree with that. I think who should win is Bong Joon-ho. I think who will win could be Sam Mendes. But again, I kind of allow myself to sort of flip that, and it could be either or. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do Best Actress. So the Best Actress nominees are Cynthia Erivo, Scarlett Johansson, Saoirse Ronan, Charlize Theron, and Renee Zellweger. I think Renee Zellweger will win, and I think she probably should win. I think just in terms of, like, as Judy Garland, it's Oscar bait. Yeah. No question.
Definition of Oscar bait.
Plays a Hollywood legend, but she nails it. She nails the singing. She nails the drama. Plus, I think, you know, Renee Zellweger is one of these, like, people who, unfortunately, because she's a woman of a certain age in Hollywood, kind of gets put on the iceberg and allowed to float out to sea.
Mm-hmm.
And she managed to steal a boat and row back.
Yeah.
So I think she's earned it. I think she deserves the recognition. And I think it's just sort of like Cynthia Erivo, again, it's kind of an Oscar baity role playing Harriet Tubman. And there's been a lot of unfortunate commentary about, you know, black women only get recognized when they're playing slaves or former slaves. Scarlett Johansson, like, of her two nominations, I think Marriage Story is the one. Saoirse Ronan, as I said, she'll be back. I'm not sure why Charlize Theron gets nominated for Bombshell, but it's a thing that happens. So I just think of the offerings, I go with Renee. What do you think?
Cool. I'm not that comfortable choosing a winner because I've only seen two of the pictures. So I actually saw Judy last night, so it's fresh in my mind, and I think it was a really great performance by Renee Zellweger. What you say, though, it is Oscar baity performance.
Yeah.
It's a very effective performance, and I think nowadays, the Academy is really, really in favor of biopics and people who
yes.
play people.
Yes.
Used to be if you played somebody who was, like, intellectually challenged or you had, that was the thing. Now it seems like if you play a real person, that's what they really like.
Three of the five nominations are real people, by the way. Yeah. Harriet Tubman, Megyn Kelly, and Judy Garland.
Yeah, yes. They really like that because they can go back on video and watch the person say, oh, you came really close to being like them.
Yeah.
I found the performance, if I was to be at all critical, because I liked it a lot, I thought it was a bit affected. You know, it's a bit like, you know, it's an actress, but that kind of went with Judy Garland, because that's probably how her life was. She's
acting with a capital A.
Yeah. Where the other movie I saw was Marriage Story, and so I would give it to Scarlett Johansson.
Fair enough.
I thought she really, really natural, really got to the core emotionally with that, and I think she was terrific in it. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen Jojo Rabbit yet, so I'd like to see that as well, because I heard she's really good in that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I thought Marriage Story is just emotionally gripping, and her and Adam Driver just play off each other so well, and I think they really get to the core of that movie.
She's really effective, and she's really, like, there's a real back and forth to that movie. It's like, is she, like, conspiring with the lawyer to screw him out, but you also see things, like, you very much understand her point of view, too. So, I mean, it's a great performance, no doubt. So Best Actor, we have Antonio Banderas, Leonardo DiCaprio, Adam Driver, Joaquin Phoenix, and Jonathan Pryce. So who do you think will win? Who should win?
Well, I'm happy to say I've seen every movie in this category, so it's the one I can be confident in.
Okay.
I would say this is the category where I'd say, where's Adam Sandler? Where's Eddie Murphy? I would have nominated both of them.
Yes.
And probably would have given it to one of them. But the... who I would give it to would be Adam Driver for Marriage Story.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, just like Scarlett Johansson, I thought he was terrific in it. He really dug down. It's almost like method acting about, you know, this dad going through a divorce and all that entails, and also a very interesting character who's a theater director in New York. It's very, very interesting backstory to that character. And I think Joaquin Phoenix will win for Joker.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a good performance, but I didn't, as I've said on the show before, I did not like the Joker.
Yeah.
Probably the movie I liked the least that I saw this year. And it's nominated for the most Oscars, which kind of makes me sick.
Wow. I would much rather choose from my list of best director, my best actor nominees, because my list is Taron Egerton, Daniel Craig, Eddie Murphy, Willem Dafoe, and Adam Sandler, and maybe not Daniel Craig, maybe replace Daniel Craig with Kang Ho Song from Parasite.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a better list than this.
Yeah, and Willem Dafoe would be interesting. I thought he was like the would be best actor. I think when he's been nominated for other awards, it's been best supporting for whatever reason.
He did a monologue while being buried alive.
What else does he need to do?
Acting with a capital A.
Yeah, he was.
So since none of those people are nominated, I think, I agree, Joaquin Phoenix will win. This has sort of been like the Joaquin Phoenix season.
Mm-hmm.
I think who should win? Give it to Antonio Banderas. This is his first Oscar nomination ever.
Yeah.
You think about like all the work he's done with Almodovar. Even in some Hollywood stuff, like he was really good in like Evita, and like also being like one of the few actual Hispanic people or Spanish people in Evita.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been a really solid performer for years. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen Pain and Glory, so I don't know how good he is in it. I imagine he's pretty good because it's, again, Almodovar.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's understated for.
Oh, good.
It's very understated. It's mature, and he smokes heroin throughout it. And he's become a little bit of an addict.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very good performance. It's very understated, which is
But I think in terms of, one of these career, like, you've been a good boy. Here's an Oscar.
Yeah.
That it should be, I would be perfectly okay with Joaquin Phoenix not winning. At least for Joker. I've said enough about the Joker anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings us to Best Picture, and the nominees are Ford v. Ferrari, The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Joker, Little Women, Marriage Story, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Parasite. And again, like I said, I think it'll be Parasite or 1917. Like, it depends, I think, on the flavor of the Academy. It won the SAG Award for Best Ensemble, which is like a Korean movie winning the American Acting Award.
Yeah.
So it could be a spoiler in that respect. I have a feeling, though, it'll be 1917 because it is cinema with a capital C.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like old-fashioned-y Hollywood. Because I think that's the root. And we talked about, not you and I, but I think it was either Candace or Peter, and we talked about the nominations on an earlier show. Like, Joker gets 11 nominations, not because I think a lot of people thought it was particularly great. I think it gets 11 nominations because it's an old-fashioned Oscar Hollywood kind of movie from a traditional studio, released the traditional way with a traditional star.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some anti-Netflix in these nominations.
Exactly. Yeah. So 1917, I think, also checks those boxes, especially since it's become a hit as well. It's become a box office hit, so could go either way for me.
Okay. So which one? You got to pick. Who do you think should win? And who would you?
I think 1917 will win. I think Parasite probably should.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not 100% comfortable on this because I've seen 5 out of the 9 movies.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna binge. I think there's about 3 or 4. I might have seen them all by Oscar night. The one I want to win would be Parasite. I thought that's the best of those nominated.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I'm going to say Parasite's going to win.
Okay.
So maybe Sam Mendes. I kind of agree with you that it's going to be split. Maybe Sam Mendes wins for director and Parasite wins for picture.
The reason I think it's like it's Bong as director and 1917 as picture is because Mendes does have a directing Oscar. So, I mean, the Oscars sometimes do that. Like, let's spread the wealth a little.
And also there's the foreign picture category. That's what they often do, right?
That's like, right. Yeah. It could, like, Parasite will definitely win Best International Film. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of paves the way to honor 1917 or, God forbid, Joker as, like, a traditional Hollywood kind of thing. And
do you think Joker would win? I think Once Upon a Time in America... In Hollywood, sorry, I always say that. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I didn't particularly like that much, it was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I think would have a better chance to win than Joker.
I mean, this is the weird thing is that I think both The Irishman and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, they are good movies.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking about Tarantino and Scorsese, like, you've got to, like, hit a home run, I think, mm-hmm. to get the Oscar, because they both have, you know, Oscars. So they really have to impress, and, you know, it has kind of crowded. I mean, I would much rather have Greta Gerwig in the mix than Scorsese, like, no offense to Scorsese,
mm-hmm.
or Tarantino for that matter, but, you know, I would have been much happier if it had been Greta Gerwig and Lulu Wang.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it is.
Yeah.
So we're going to get to our dealer's choice category. So Tim, why don't you? What's your choice, and for the category you want to talk about, and who should win and who will win?
So my choice was, because I've seen 4 out of the 5. It was Best Supporting Actor.
Okay.
So the only one I haven't seen is Tom Hanks. I imagine he's amazing. He's really good.
Yeah.
I think I said it on an earlier show. You know, he's had his time, right? Like,
yeah.
I bet he's good in it, though. I haven't seen. Have you seen that?
No, I have not seen A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, but I also imagine Tom Hanks can do Mr. Rogers in his sleep.
Yeah.
I can't think of anyone else who you would get to play Mr. Rogers. Like, who would you get? Malcolm McDowell? No. Although I would like to see that.
Yeah. Get The Rock.
Oh, Dwayne Johnson as Mr. Rogers. Oh, my God.
That'd be good.
Oh,
yeah. So, all right. Actually, because I'd seen some other award ceremony stuff, I said, actually, who wasn't nominated, who I would have nominated, is Willem Dafoe, like you mentioned before, for The Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. I thought he was amazing, but he's not nominated. Mm-hmm. So I would pick Joe Pesci for The Irishman.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really, really great performance, really understated, and it brought me back to, like, the first two Godfather movies and, like, Al Pacino in those movies. Mm-hmm. You know, he's known for being way more over the top these days, but just that sort of restrained, where you can see he's got all this power, but he's not extroverted about it. It's all inside, and you can just see it in his eyes, and how he has power over Robert De Niro's character in that movie, I think.
Over everybody, like that whole scene in the Florida where he's meeting the guy from New York, and he's late. Mm-hmm. And he comes to the meeting in like Bermuda shorts and a t-shirt, and he's like, "This is how you dress for a meeting?" I love that scene. It's probably my favorite scene in The Irishman, because there's a comedic element to it, but there's something so sinister underneath.
Yeah, and Joe Pesci's been great over the years with Robert De Niro and Scorsese, like Raging Bull. I don't think he won Best Supporting for that.
No.
I think he won for Goodfellas.
He won for Goodfellas, yeah.
Yes. Give him another one.
Why give not? Him another one, yeah. Well, I mean, it's also like he hasn't done a movie since, I think, 07. So,
mm-hmm.
got him out of retirement.
I think Brad Pitt will win, and I'm not opposed to that. I thought he was the best thing about Once Upon a Time
Absolutely.
In Hollywood.
Absolutely.
But I would rather Joe Pesci win.
And that's another sort of like career
thing.
Like, you know, Brad Pitt, you've been around for a while, have an Oscar. Yeah. I chose the screenplay categories to correct some wrongs. So I think Best Adapted should go to Greta Gerwig for Little Women, obviously, because, you know, she got, let's admit it, cock-blocked from Best Director. And also, you know, I don't find the category too spectacular. I think this might be the category. I think she will win, too,
because
I think a lot of people in the Academy are going to be feeling that, too. It's like, you know, here's a hot new talent. Here she took an established novel and updated it and made it real for a modern audience.
Mm-hmm. I thought she should have won for Lady Bird, although that's tough. That was the same year as Jordan Peele for Get Out.
Yes, but, that's true.
But, like, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Another corrective measure I would add, since he didn't win Best Director. And then for Best Original Screenplay, I'm going to give it to Rian Johnson for Knives Out. Though I think Marriage Story might be a strong... Could win, strong mm-hmm. will win. Also, I wouldn't be surprised if they gave it to Quentin Tarantino because...
He's Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. And... But, like, for Rian Johnson, who's been, like, doing, like, really good work, like, really, like, in, especially in the, like, the murder mystery genre. Yeah.
That was a great movie, and I think it's been snubbed not being one of the nine nominated, probably.
I would agree with that. It isn't changing lives, but it is, it is so well-crafted and so well-acted, and it's really enjoyable. All right, so will we be right? You'll have to tune in on Sunday and see. And I will just leave it at that. Let's cue up a little more Oscar music before we get into the non-Oscar nominated Uncut Gems. Talk about modern grime. We'll be right back on End Credits. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. No water. Lesson learned. That is a clip from Uncut Gems. It's the new movie from Benny and Josh Safdie, and it stars Adam Sandler, Julia Fox, and Idina Menzel, Kevin Garnett, the basketball player. That's not a new actor named Kevin Garnett.
No, playing himself.
Playing himself. Lakeith Stanfield, Eric Bogosian, and Judd Hirsch.
This blew my mind.
Yeah, I joked at the time of the show, it's a white knuckle, but it's like... There is so much tension in this movie. It's crazy. And it's not like it's ultra... I mean, it is violent at times. But the way it's directed, and so much of it is like on Adam Sandler's shoulders.
For sure.
Because he has to sell... He's the one who sells the tension of it because he's constantly moving. Even when he's sitting down, he's constantly moving. He can't sit still. Yeah. He's... Like, the walls are closing in. He is this, like, chronic degenerate gambler. Yeah. He owes everybody.
He makes bad decision after bad decision.
Chronically bad decisions.
And you still, like, feel for him, right? You're still empathetic towards him. And he's actually a terrible person, if you think about it, but you're empathetic towards him, right? It's just one of those...
He's completely terrible. And it's this area. It takes place in New York, and it's this area that New York that probably a lot of people have heard of, the Diamond District, where there's a lot of jewelers. I don't think it gets a lot... Like, in terms of, like, movie New York, it's not the place we visit too often. So
no, I Googled it, and, like, 95% of... the value of diamond goes through there.
Yeah.
Goes through the Diamond District. And I think it had like a cameo in Marathon Man back in the day, 1976, right at the end of that movie.
Deep cut.
Deep cut. But deep uncut gems. But yeah, and I read about the Safdies, you know, choosing this because, you know, it's tough because New York City now, like compared to the 70s, 80s,
yeah,
is not nowhere near as gritty. Like if you visit there,
yeah,
it's so they're fine, there's still these pockets where,
yeah,
there's like interesting stuff going on where there's like, you know, wheeling and dealing going on under the table and stuff like that.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this is sort of like fictionalized or sort of accentuated, because it's like on every corner, like he's walking down the street and somebody's trying to hustle him or he's trying to hustle somebody.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's a very 80s sort of feeling to it, and that's in like the music where there's like this synth score. And I wrote down the composer's name, Daniel Lipiden, who... I think this is his first film score ever.
Yeah, it's really good too.
Yeah, and so like there's like these like psychedelic where it goes like inside this opal, this like rainbow colored opal where it's like all these like sort of like it looks like a lava lamp in there, and it
yeah.
transitions to a colonoscopy at the beginning of the film. But
yeah.
it's like this very psychedelic kind of feeling, this very kind of early 80s kind of feeling, you know, at a time when, you know, Escape from New York. It was perfectly believable in 1981 that the government would decide, like, New York is going to hell. We're just going to blow up all the bridges and fill all the tunnels and leave it to its own devices and make it to make it a prison. So it really captures a bit of, though it takes place in the modern day or 2012 anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It really captures a sense of a lost New York, a little lost world in New York.
For sure, and I just thought, like when I left the theater, it felt like I'd been hit in the face with a frying pan, but I enjoyed it, you know?
Right.
It's like, and there's movies, those are like the movies that really, you know, those are the movies that like change lives, might be hyperbolic, but like that
yeah.
really like change your perspective on things and you think about after. And I'd say this year, Parasite, I thought about it for hours after.
Yeah.
And I thought Uncut Gems, I thought about it for days after. This was just such an effective picture. It's on Netflix now, but I would recommend mm-hmm. going to see it in a theater with other people who you'll all walk out like zombies at the end. It's quite the experience.
I watched it on Netflix. I'm not sure I can recommend that because, like, I think you underestimate, like, the relief of the pause button. Just
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I have to stop for a minute. I have to stop and not worry about what's going to happen to this guy for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And, It's really, because speaking of like coming out of like feeling like a zombie, the climax of this movie is people watching a basketball game.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you watch this in a theater because like I was standing up watching this.
Yeah.
And like pacing, like yeah. I had money on the basketball
yeah.
game.
Yeah.
I was just so invested in the outcome. And this is like, it's so, but the climax of this movie, and I was thinking about this as I was watching, this is the climax of the movie, people watching TV. This is how
yeah.
on edge I am.
Yeah, well, Adam, and that's Adam Sandler right there, right? And that's the direction by the Safdies too, but Adam Sandler in that the scene at the end, watching the game,
mm-hmm.
he's so invested. He's talking about his bet, which is all this crazy prop bet where if this happens, this happens. This,
right.
The dominoes have to fall in the right way for him to win like
yes.
over $1 million.
Yes.
So he can finally pay off his debts and, you know, his family won't get killed or whatever, right? And it's just like, it's just crazy, like, how good he is at getting you into that world. And
mm-hmm.
I think in real life, he's a basketball fan, so that probably helped. But, like,
mm-hmm.
just all the gambling lingo and everything, and you might not understand what he's talking about, but you can understand.
Yeah, it went
you
over
know,
my head.
You can understand what he's cheering for, right?
Right.
He needs the Celtics to do well, and Kevin Garnett, who acts in it, to do well.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting with Kevin Garnett, who does a great job as an athlete in this movie.
Yeah.
You know? He gets the opal diamond, right?
Yeah.
He needs that because he thinks
he becomes obsessed with it.
He's
yeah.
superstitious over it because he
yeah.
has a great game when he has it with him. He has a lousy game when he doesn't. So
yeah.
he just really wants this diamond.
It's yeah. This is an interesting movie for like, because the acting is so great, and it depends on Adam Sandler, who has again shown a lot of range, but is not known as an actor in,
mm-hmm.
in quote marks. You have Julia Fox, who plays his girlfriend. This is like her first like role, Like, she's directed films, but this is, like, the first time she's acted in a movie.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You have Kevin Garnett, who I think this is the first time he's acted in a movie. He's playing, like, I guess a character based on him.
I think so, yeah.
But, you know, so he's coming in here with not a lot of acting experience.
No.
You have, like, cameos by The Weeknd.
Yeah, Weeknd. Weeknd was awesome as The Weeknd in this, yeah.
And, but at the same time, you have you also have Eric Bogosian, who's like this character actor. A lot of people probably remember him best as the bad guy in Under Siege 2.
Under Siege 2. Talk radio in the 80s. He was amazing as the
disc. Oh, yes, yes. That's one of Oliver Stone's first films as a director. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a scene where Eric Bogosian is the loan shark that Adam Sandler owes a lot of money to. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you understand that they're related until the Passover scene.
Right. And it's
because I didn't really get that.
No, until, it's not. That's how they're revealing it. And they reveal it very subtly during that scene. All of a sudden you look across the table
and it's Eric Bogosian.
This guy who's like threatening his life over this money is his brother-in-law sitting right across the table from
him. And it's
him.
After...
Spoiler alert on that, I guess.
Yeah, but no, it's interesting. And I think it's after a scene where... The goons surprise Howard, the Adam Sandler character, at his kid's play.
School play, yeah.
And they chase him around the school, get him into a car. And, like, that was a tense scene. Like, you have, like, five guys in this one car, and you can, like, feel the tightness of it.
Yeah.
Like, the frame is, like, right in there, and I can't imagine how they must have shot this. But they strip him, stick him in the trunk of his car, and then... couple of scenes later, they're at Passover together, and Eric Bogosian is just like staring at him across the table, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Howard's still like kind of hustling, and he's had like a fight with his girlfriend, and he's struggling to sell this opal, and Eric Bogosian is just like sitting across the table, staring at him, intensely.
Or when they go to that other room after the dinner.
Oh yeah.
And Adam Sandler, because he's a braggart, he's bragging about the opal.
Yes.
And Eric Bogosian's just there, like, okay.
Yeah.
You've got money then. You've got something of value here.
Yeah. It's
you know,
it's so it's just so. And the great thing about the movie is that it manages to like you're able to understand the mindset of like gambling addiction. I think I read somebody's comment on this on somewhere, but it's like somebody said it's like the requiem for a dream of like gambling addiction.
Yeah.
Because you're able to understand the point of view of the gambling addict and the high and the rush.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the lingo is complicated.
Yeah, but you get it. It's like watching like a medical drama in an emergency room. It doesn't matter. You don't understand, but you understand what's happening. It's life or death. And with him, it's just like... almost like every moment with him is kind of like life or death, but he's just, I don't know, he's just making bad decision after bad decision. Just, you know, he thinks he's doing what's right, or, you know, he thinks he's getting ahead in the world, and he's not.
He thinks he's in control the whole time, but the way the Safdies sort of follow the action, and I think Howard understands he's not in control, but he can't stop, because then he really is out of control.
Right.
Like trying to like sell his, you know, memorabilia and sell his watch and move this in order to buy that.
Yeah.
He can't stop, because the moment he stops, he drowns. There's a very kind of like, I guess, shark quality to that.
Yeah.
That he has to keep going.
And there's that excellent scene after the auction where he gets beat up on the street by the thugs.
Yeah.
And he just... He gets like throat punched.
Yeah.
Falls down. You think, okay, is he going to be okay? Is he going to have to go to the hospital? He gets right back up to try to like ingratiate himself with the thugs again.
Right.
Say, oh, I can get you guys money. It's all good. Just following after them. They're not the ones chasing. It's like funny. It's the.
Yes.
He's the victim chasing after them.
They've had enough. They're like, we got to figure out what to do with this guy. And he's still trying to convince them. And I actually found that scene actually more harrowing than the scene with the when they strip him and dump him in the trunk.
Yeah.
Even though like both these scenes are like super intense, and like the whole point of this film is like you're waiting for Howard to get it. You're waiting for like him to hit bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And when at what point do these loan sharks and everybody like have enough of like dealing with this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's in the back of your mind in every scene. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to spoil the ending, but it's funny that the moment sort of the tension lifts is when the unexpected, although I kind of expected it, but it is interesting that the tension lifts for one brief second right there before the end.
And then it's just, I didn't expect that. I actually didn't expect it to happen right at that moment.
Yeah.
So that's like where the frying pan hit my face.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's interesting stuff at the end too, like with Julia Fox's character and this strange dude she meets in the helicopter.
Right.
Right. And it just shows, and I love how the Safdies play with your perception of this guy.
Yeah.
You think this guy is going to be violent, or that's what I'm thinking, right?
Yes.
You're judging a book by its cover, right?
Yeah.
This guy is going to be violent. He's going to do something here, you know? Why is she trusting this guy?
Well, you also expect her to be a hustler, right?
Mm-hmm.
That she, like, you know, she's maybe had enough of Howard, too. She had, basically has all of Howard's money at that point, so, like, what does she need Howard for?
Mm-hmm.
And you expect her to sort of have her own kind of side hustle in all of this, and goes to, you know, snap, speaking of snap judgments, it turns out she might be the most sort of pure of all the people in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because Idina Menzel, that's another, you know, she's well known as sort of like a Broadway actress. She was in Wicked, and she did like the singing voice for one of the characters in Frozen.
For Frozen, she did the main song in that, right?
But she's not known as
Let
like,
it go.
Right. She isn't known as like an actor. In terms of like film acting, you do get the sense like it's a very Carmela Soprano kind of thing where it's mm-hmm. like, I know my husband is like a no good Nick, but you know what, you kind of have, when you're in hell, the only way out is through. So there's that.
And there's a great scene where she lays down the law with him, right?
Yeah.
Like he's coming back to her cause he thinks like Julia Fox, he's on the outs with her.
Yeah.
Cause she has an encounter with the Weeknd and he's like really jealous.
So then, I can't believe the Weeknd.
The Weeknd's right there. And this is funny because this is a period piece because it's like from 2012.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, there's this new guy from Canada called The Weeknd.
Yeah.
Who's really tearing it up. Let's go see The Weeknd.
Yeah, that's right.
But she has this great sort of little monologue with Adam Sandler, Howard, where she's just saying, you're a terrible person.
Yeah.
I want nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
We're going to have a divorce after Passover, then it's done, right?
Not even that, but like the scene where he's locked in the trunk naked and she has to come out and open the trunk because she has the fob. And she opens the trunk and he gets out naked and she doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
She just kind of like...
She's going to be shocked or something.
She just kind of like stares at him. It's like at the kids' play, really.
Yeah.
And then goes back into the school. It's such a great sort of like dismissal and she doesn't say anything at all. And she was great.
Yeah.
Everybody was great.
Yeah, the whole cast was great. It was definitely, for me, it was probably the best movie I saw this year. And it's one of the best movies I've ever seen. I thought it was just great. And it's interesting. I think Martin Scorsese was an executive producer for it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I look at a movie like The Joker and when we were critiquing that, you know, it had elements of Taxi Driver and King of Comedy and stuff, but I thought it kind of just bolted those onto the film.
Yeah.
They didn't really fit. With this, I think it really fits. It's almost like he's taken like a gritty, almost like Sidney Lumet, Martin Scorsese movie, or they are, I should say, the Safdies. And Ronald Bronstein, who wrote the screenplay with them. And they've just taken it to a whole other level, I think, of like tension and just...
It's very Mean Streets because, I mean, Mean Streets was about Robert De Niro basically being out of control.
I agree, and he owed money, and he wouldn't.
Yeah, so all it was missing is like a Harvey Keitel character trying to keep him on the straight and narrow. And this has been a very good year for Martin Scorsese, because the Irishman. It's also been a very good year for people like paying homage to Martin Scorsese, because you do get uncut gems. Hustlers 2 is very much a Martin Scorsese movie, but like from the women's point of view, directed mm-hmm. by a woman. And I think Martin Scorsese was like considering directing Hustlers for like a hot second, but you can't have. I don't think you can have either of those movies, Uncut Gems or Hustlers, or actually even Joker for that matter, without Scorsese. So The man is relevant.
And also on Netflix, and I watched it basically. I'd never seen a Safdie's brother movie before. Good Time is on Netflix, so I watched it. It's a really, really interesting, cool movie. But I think they've taken to the next level with this, so I can't wait to see what they do next.
Yeah, no, and I agree, and I might have to go and revisit that too, because I didn't know they had more stuff on Netflix, but I will check that out too. And that, we have to call an end for our show this week, unfortunately. If you liked it and you want to listen to it again, find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download the show from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. We're also on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Tim, where can people find you on Das Internet?
Das Internet and the Deutschland sites.
That's right.
I have strictly German websites now.
Awesome.
A lot of fans in Germany. Flash in the Deadpan. It's on all the channels, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. But I've got a German German plan now. Thanks, Adam.
Excellent. I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can find my political site at guelphpolitico.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits. We'll see you then.